Hi, I'm Frances Anderton and this is DNA. Netflix is tackling the art of design and the creative process of designers with the goal of illuminating
how the world tends to function, whether that's the shape and curvature and lines on a car or the colors and materials on your sneakers. Design pervades just about every aspect of our lives.
Hear more from Scott Dadich, the creator of Abstract, later in the show. First up, though, if you live in LA these days, you may be feeling deluged by billboards and mailers for a March 7 ballot initiative called Measure S. The billboards supporting the measure promise to, quote, save our neighborhoods. But what would be the actual impact of Measure S on our cityscape? We invited Mark Valianatos of the pro-development group Abundant Housing and Dick Platkin, a former planner for the City of Los Angeles who worked on its general plan. We walked them through specific projects to find out what would happen to them if Measure S passes. First, though, we asked them for their stance on the measure, starting with Mark Valianatos.
I oppose Measure S, and I do so mainly because I think it's going to make our housing crisis worse, which will in turn worsen homelessness, make people pay more for rent, make it harder for young people to afford to be able to move out of the parents' house and even to stay in the region. And also, I feel like it provides a roadblock to the positive evolution of LA to become more sustainable, more equitable, more innovative. So for those reasons, I think we need to defeat Measure S.
Dick.
I wasn't part of the people who drafted Measure S, but once I read about it, I immediately gravitated to it. And the basic reason is that I don't see how a city that is as large as LA and as complex as LA can operate without a carefully crafted and monitored general plan that will address all of the land uses in LA. And having worked on it before, I know that it is a carefully thought out plan. It has designated areas for high density housing, for tall buildings. It has areas for low rise buildings, and it has areas for strictly residential areas.
I think both of you agree that one needs a good general plan, but Mark, you might say that one needs an updated general plan.
Definitely, it'd be great to have an updated general plan and updated community plans. So it's easier to build more housing in the right places without having to go through the complex process to get exceptions. But since right now that's not the case, we have old plans. Like, I live in Northeast LA. We have a plan from 1999. So in that case, you need to allow people to transform parking lots into housing or transform abandoned car dealers into mixed-use buildings, because otherwise we're just going to continue to get hammered by high housing costs.
And that gives rise to a phenomenon called spot zoning, where variances are given to change the use or change the scale or change the density of a project that the Measure S side believes is tied up with a corrupt system of planning whereby developers will give contributions to political campaigns and in return for those will get variances on projects. Is that right?
Well, to me, the two biggest impacts of Measure S will be a two-year moratorium on zone changes and a essentially permanent ban on general plan amendments. And that will make it harder to, on a site-by-site basis, do something different.
The planning process is fine. It's the distortions of the planning process that are the problem.
Okay. So let's take some specific projects. There is currently an image that is circulating from the pro-Measure S side. It puts Frank Gehry's project on Sunset Strip called 8150 Sunset. This is a proposed five-structure development. It includes two residential towers. One of those towers goes to 15 stories. The project was reduced in scale because there was a lot of opposition to it. But still, the Measure S folks have juxtaposed an image of this project with the words, quote, Trump money fuels Trump-like tower at 8150 Sunset. There seems to be an implication that if you vote for Measure S, that maybe this project goes away. If Measure S were to pass, would this project be in any way affected?
Well, first of all, we don't know what will happen to projects that are in the pipeline. It depends where they are in the permitting process. It's very possible that many of the major projects that are there right now will be vested. And that means that if Measure S passes, they would still be able to go through. I'm sure many of them would be litigated and they would be sued. So there's four separate lawsuits right now for the 8150 project. Those lawsuits will not go away, but it might not be stopped by Measure S.
Mark.
And in fact, this project didn't require or didn't seek a zone change or a general plan amendment. So I think this is a strange project for Measure S supporters to focus on and to protest outside, because even if their measure passed, it wouldn't stop it.
Okay. Vintage Westwood Horizons. This is a building in Westwood Village occupied by something like 200 very elderly folk who have received eviction notices from the company that now owns the building. Yes on S released a video about the seniors threatened with eviction at Vintage Westwood Horizons. Again, implication somehow being that the seniors might not be evicted were Measure S to succeed.
Measure S only at this point affects projects that require a legislative approval from the City Planning Commission and the City Council. There is an implication of Measure S that there would be what are called ministerial permits. Those are things that do not require legislative actions, that they must be consistent with the general plan. So there could be many projects like the one in Westwood that would be subject to a legal challenge if Measure S passed, but at this point, Measure S would not stop that project.
Mark?
I agree with that analysis. And further, I'd say that if we think about projects that would be impacted by Measure S, tend to be larger projects that are taking what I consider an underutilized piece of land, like a parking lot or an industrial building, and they're seeking a zone change or general plan amendment to get commercial zoning or residential zoning to put up a big thing there. The positive thing about these projects is that they create a lot of housing and they don't evict or displace existing units because it's just a barren parking lot. Now it's 500 units of housing. The other way we build housing is like an investor will buy a 20-unit apartment building, rent stabilized, right? You can use Ellis Act to get people out.
Which is what's happened at Vintage Westwood Horizons.
Can, yeah, do like 40 or 50 condos later on. And you've increased the housing supply, but you've also evicted people. So I think ironically, if Measure S passes, if we have the same demand for new housing, it could force that pressure into our existing multifamily areas and actually increase evictions and increase displacement.
Okay, that's a good segue to Palladium Residences. This was a project that seems to have kicked off the whole fight to start with. Miami-based developer Crescent Heights, they have approval to build two 28-story buildings on a large parking lot. The towers would create something like 731 residential units, as well as 37 units of affordable housing. This project really enraged Michael Weinstein, who heads the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. He supported the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative, which has now become Measure S. Would the Palladium Residences be stopped if Measure S were to pass?
The Palladium does have a general plan amendment. It might not be stopped retroactively, but projects like this that are built outside the areas of Hollywood that are already planned and zoned for tall, high-density buildings would be affected. You could still do it after 2 years, but it would have to be for an area that's at least 15 acres or larger.
Mark?
I feel like this project has already moved far enough along they wouldn't be blocked, but it is a good example of the type of project to be harder in the future or just impossible. And to me, this is a mixed use, mixed income building, two blocks from transit. Or this is what the future of Los Angeles, what we need. And to have, this one guy up in his tower look out and worry about his views and then kick off this initiative to stop transit-oriented development is really disappointing, really terrifying if you really care about a more sustainable future for LA. So I think it is a good symbol of what the fight is about.
Okay. What about 333 La Cienega? This is a project that was given approval by the City Council just a week or so ago. It's a project of the developer Rick Caruso, he of The Grove, Americana. Rick Caruso is reported to have given hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions, but also to have been asked to put a big chunk of change into the Affordable Housing Fund. The towers would come down from 20 stories to 16 in order to get this approval. What are the implications for that project of Measure S, Dick?
Well, I happen to live near that project, and I've been very involved in it. This project could be easily have built a half a mile to the south, where the plans and the zones encourage high density, encourage high-rise buildings, and where there will be a subway station. His choice was to build in an area that's zoned and planned for 45 feet, And we've argued consistently that this type of project should be built where it's planned. It should not be built where it isn't planned. And we also don't buy the argument that this will somehow address LA's housing crisis. LA's housing crisis is for affordable housing. These units will average $12,000 per month. Half of the people, according to Mr. Caruso, won't even live in LA. These are totally disconnected housing markets, and you can build a glut of high-priced luxury housing, and it won't do anything for the people who need housing in LA. If we truly want to build affordable housing, we have to go back to the programs that have worked. We can't do it by simply manipulating the market by incentives to developers. It simply doesn't work.
Mark?
Actually, I agree with Dick that we need to give a lot more resources to build affordable housing and to subsidize low-income families. But Measure S doesn't do any of those changes he asked for. And in fact, it would make it harder for some affordable projects to be built because they need general plan amendments like many projects do. I mean, if you don't build for the upper middle class, they go out and they outbid the middle class, they outbid the working class, right? So we need to add more housing of all types. And Measure S just would shut down some of the ways we get housing, and that would hurt everyone.
I just want to get one clarification. Dick, you said that the Rick Caruso project, the La Cienega project, had he built it on the site that is zoned for that kind of housing, it would have been near a transit stop. It would
have been
near mass transit. And yet, so the same could be said of Palladium residences. They will be near a transit stop. And yet, the Measure S folks want to stop projects like the Palladium residences. So are they for projects at transit stops or are they not?
The question is where it's planned. The issue is there are many places in Hollywood that are near transit stops where high-density development is planned. It doesn't mean that you can build high-density housing everywhere.
Let's move to downtown. One can generally build higher in downtown, but there's a project on the boards now that would require a zoning variance, as I understand it, and this is one called 670 Mesquite, being designed by the Danish architect Bjarke Ingels, potentially a very interesting project. It will bring a massive jump in scale to the Arts District where it is slated to be. The whole thing is being conceived as a project for the future, really, of the kind that you're quite supportive of, I think, Mark.
Yeah, both this project and the 6 a.m. project.
By Herzog and de Meuron, let's mention that. That would have been my next one. That would be at Alameda and 6th. Herzog and de Meuron, Swiss architects, also do very interesting projects. They want a couple of towers that would be around 58 stories, as well as lower level development.
Yeah, so both of these projects, I think, are, I'm not a designer, I'm a policy person, but they look cool. And they would incorporate interesting features and mixes of uses. And I feel like even beyond that, the Arts District itself is an example of how some of these site-by-site changes, even if they're kind of irregular in the planning system, they've actually allowed the kind of creation of almost a real neighborhood in a place that used to be either just entirely industrial or just be a hidden, you know, a hidden treasure for a few artists who are living there in lofts. And what's really interesting is that if we say just we ban all these zone changes and general plan amendments and just wait for the downtown plan to be updated, if we hadn't allowed those projects to start growing there, probably the city planners would say, this is industrial, we're going to keep it industrial, right? So you'd never have this flourishing neighborhood coming out of nothing. And so I think it's a good example of how sometimes we do want to allow innovation, allow prototyping, allow people to try new things in places that might be unexpected, and maybe something good will emerge. And so I look at the Arts District as an example of the need for flexibility in zoning. And I look forward to hopefully these two projects not being stopped by Measure S, but actually getting built.
Dick?
In doing research, I read about what is the actual impact for the residents of the Art District of these unplanned projects when they're emerging. And the fact is the artists are being driven out. So the people who will live there have no connection to the arts community that is there right now. These will be people who can afford 1,000 square foot condominiums that cost $1 million. So we know that the artists who are living there are not going to be able to stay.
But I don't think artists are currently living in the Rancho cold storage facility.
Which is where
the Bjarke Ingels project would be.
It's part of a broad phenomena in the Arts District by having expensive housing where there has been low-priced housing, often illegal housing, people living in lofts. But the artists have been there, and they have found a way to live there, and they are being displaced.
Mark?
Just wanted to say that the research on displacement and gentrification shows that if an area is gentrifying, like the Arts District is, if you add new market-rate units, you actually slow displacement rather than increase it. And the reason is you know, pretty clear if you think about, you know, any community in LA, like Highland Park, for example, near where I live. If you don't build new units, the people with more money will go and outbid the existing residents for existing spaces, existing homes. And so even though I agree with Dick, I want to see more actually workforce housing, deeded affordable housing, like all these kind of creative solutions. If we try to stop new market rate housing because it's quote unquote luxury, we really hurt the people at the bottom, not the people who can afford to live anywhere.
Is Measure S, Dick, nostalgic? Is it trying to take us back or keep us at a sort of status quo level?
I don't buy that at all. Having worked on the actual general plan, the general plan is a visionary document. It clearly stated that LA needs to have areas that are planned for density, are planned for transit. This has been the planning principle of all plans in the city of Los Angeles since 1970. There's nothing nostalgic about that. The adopted planning policies of the city of LA are in no way trying to maintain a dispersed suburban environment. It's trying to transform it into a higher density area, but in a methodical, organized way where you look at the infrastructure, you look at services, and you try to designate exactly those areas that should have higher and greater density, not just allow some developer to walk into the mayor's office and say, well, I don't care about your plans. I don't care about your zones. I want to build here, like 333 South La Cienega, and have enough political juice to push it through. We want transparency. We want to have a planned process to transform the city. We don't want to have it left just to whatever are the latest trends in real estate development, which right now apparently is just a massive inflow of investment and speculative capital from China. Next year, that might change. It might be tattoo parlors are what the people want to invest in. We want to have an orderly, organized, carefully monitored process for running a city of 4 million people.
Will there be a measure against tattoo parlors?
I hope not.
Mark?
I feel like many of the Measure S supporters do have a vision of Los Angeles that is worried about the direction we're going. They're worried about transit. They're worried about large buildings. And I feel like I'm optimistic about the direction LA is moving. I feel like a lot of younger people and lower income people in the city do want and need change. And that Measure S would put a blockage, at least in our ability to create enough housing for those types of people. And so I feel like we really need to defeat S and look to the future, look to the transit, look to better plans, and look to like creativity to build our way out of this crisis.
Mark Valionatos, Dick Platkin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
It's great.
Mark Valionatos, co-founder of pro-development group Abundant Housing, also serves on the Zoning Advisory Committee for Recode LA. Dick Platkin, retired LA city planner. Read his weekly column at CityWatch. If you want to learn more about Measure S and its potential impacts, go to kcrw.com/DNAblog. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up after this break, 8 visionary designers get the Netflix treatment. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Scott Dadich was longtime editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, but when he pitched the idea of a show about designers to Netflix, he didn't want it to be a chef's table full of techies. Instead, he singled out his favorite designers across a range of disciplines from different generations, from heads of large offices to solitary creators. The result is Abstract, The Art of Design. It premieres on Netflix this Friday, February 10th, and over 8 episodes, you'll learn about the design processes, motivations, and backgrounds of subjects including interior designer Ilza Crawford, illustrator Christoph Niemann, and stage designer S. Deflin. We opened our conversation by talking about one of his longtime heroines of graphic design, Paula Scher. She's partner at Pentagram Design Company, who got her start back in the heyday of rock and roll.
Paula is an absolute legend, and she talks about that arc of her career and what position she believes she finds herself in today. I think probably her most famous design, or she might say it's her most infamous design, is the Boston record cover, where the earth is exploding and these giant guitar spaceships are escaping with the inhabitants of Earth as they take off. It's sort of a classic 70s yacht rock, glam rock kind of staple in the record world. And she certainly has quite a bit of notoriety for that design, but not one of her favorite designs.
The Boston cover is dumb. I am still mystified by how something like that really resonates in culture. I mean, it predated Star Wars, so we must have hit a zeitgeist that was about to happen. But when I die, it will say, "Design the Boston cover." And I've lived with this horror ever since, and I think it may wind up being true.
It's that point in the episode that leads to her talking about how she actually misses the handmade era of graphic design that those album covers were part of. You know, she misses the sort of paste-up aspect of graphic design. She now helms a department of graphic designers that are all strapped to their computers, and she's kind of monitoring their work. And then she goes home to her place in Connecticut and she paints because she needs that connection with the handcraft. Was that a piece of the sort of larger story of design that you wanted to tease out?
That's absolutely right. And that is such an interesting thematic element that as technology has been added into design processes, the work of a designer has changed over time. Whereas Paula might spend days or weeks creating a design by hand back before the age of desktop layout software, she now can realize designs in a matter of minutes with her team. So that's changed both the work volume that she has pursued, the amount of design that she's been able to achieve in her career. But you're right, she does note that particular lack, that feeling of disconnection, like almost her hands have been cut off when she moved away from actually using physical materials to create the design language that she so famously pioneered.
Now, you have another interesting designer. They're all interesting, but you have another designer who's also kind of grappling with the implications of change, and that is Ralph Gill, who's the car designer. He was born in 1970. He is of a Haitian family, raised in Montreal. He's now head of global design at Fiat Chrysler. His story is so interesting. It's partly his personal story, how he becomes a car designer. It's a lot to do with the kind of crisis at Chrysler and how he has to sort of help save the brand. But a third piece to it I took away is his own kind of ambivalence at the shift from, I guess, the analog school of driving, as in when you drove the car yourself, to automation and the self-driving car.
The romantic car lover in me wonders if one day, if everything is automated, do people care about the car anymore? Is it just another device, just like a train or something, or some other device to get to work or whatever? But there's still this solid base of people that just love the freedom and making their own decisions.
Ralph illuminated that ambivalence early on in talking about how his very craft is changing, how the design aspects of automobile and automotive design are in very rapid evolution. We tend to think about automotive design in the very luxurious tones and colors and curves, the very sexy appeal of a gorgeously designed car. All of those factors are related to a human driver, and all of the interior details, the contouring on a knob or the position of a steering wheel, all of those decisions get called into question when there is a robotic driver or no human driver. And Ralph talks about that extensively, how they think about the interior of a space. What actually is that called? What is it used for? And how will technology actually affect the more visceral and passionate sides of driving, the things that we would pursue for fun?
Now, one of the other kind of overarching themes that seems to come through in your series is that designers are inherently an optimistic breed. They're creating something. It's rather nice to have that sentiment right now when there's a feeling of sort of conflict in the air and, you know, upset around what's going on sort of in politics. And possibly the designer that embodies that to the max could be Bjarke Ingels, who's early 40s, astonishingly successful Danish-born designer, now has a huge firm based in New York. Tell us about Bjarke.
Bjarke's someone who wills fictions into reality. He talks a lot about this in an almost Inception-like framework.
You know, in real life, you can't really realize your dreams because you have so many constraints. But whereas in the dream world, they could do all these kinds of things. And when architecture is at its best, that's exactly what you're doing. You're coming up with something that is pure fiction. And then after all the hard work and all the permits and all the budgeting and all the construction, it now becomes concrete reality.
He talks about this idea of shaping realities into these visions of his buildings, and he has quite a knack for language, for spinning these tales into reality, and it's why his clients have given him so much leeway and trusted in him to create such compelling design frameworks. And we've seen that with his proposed design for the two World Trade Center. He's just been commissioned by Google to create not only the Mountain View headquarters, but also their headquarters in London and a range of other projects. But they are really exceptionally dynamic designs. They capture the imagination in a way that I think very few architects on the planet do today.
Just before the end of last year, the New York Times ran a magazine feature that looked at design and basically asked the question, is there a kind of mania for redesign that's gone too far? There are sometimes, you know, things can be sort of over-designed, badly designed. Design can create errors as well as successes. Did you feel that was part of your analysis?
There's certainly a sort of relentlessness to design, and especially, I would say, as there are more opportunities for design programming. I think one of the examples that sticks out to me in thinking about that question is Tinker Hatfield and talking about the span of work that he did with Michael Jordan in creating the Air Jordan line.
For Nike.
What an incredible career Tinker has had, but he talks very specifically about those moments where, because of the relentlessness, because of the pace, that 8 or 9 year period where he was working on the Air Jordans and couldn't design fast enough really did take a toll on him in his ability to be with his wife and daughters, and actually what he ultimately saw about the quality of his favorite designs. Now, he obviously recovered so beautifully and has done so many important projects since then, but we do explore in Tinker's episode in particular the challenge of that pace and when every design is good enough and when those aren't. And I think he explores that really beautifully.
But that relentlessness could also, I guess, be applied to consumption of design. You know, Nike's a really good example. You know, one has arms races between teenagers at high schools, you know, over Nike Air Jordans, which is kind of crazy in some ways. You know, can design and the notion that business needs design, can it lend itself to a kind of mania?
That's exactly it. And that tension is something that's really interesting. I think it exists in a lot of different fields of design. Certainly that moment, especially with the Air Jordan 11, very much caught Tinker and his colleagues at Nike by surprise. I think none of them had anticipated the tension that that would have caused and how there were actual fights and riots that erupted in pursuit of that shoe. And to think about and to contemplate that a piece of design can create that kind of human conflict is sort of crazy. It's certainly something that he feels deeply about and feels a great responsibility after that experience.
Scott Dadich, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm so pleased to share. Thank you so much for having me.
Scott Dadich is creator and executive producer of Abstract, The Art of Design. It premieres this Friday, February 10th on Netflix. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening.